All right, good afternoon, everyone. And many thanks to Cheryl and my fellow panelists and you all for the opportunity to be here today and speak a little bit about the Tobacco Control Act and the Center for Tobacco Products. Can everybody hear me? I'm getting a strange... Okay, great. These are tough acts to follow, clearly. Honestly, I was a little bit intimidated when I realized who I was sitting on the panel with, so this is a great honor. And I'd also like to say that given my current role with the FDA, I work in the Office of Policy in the Public Health Liaison Branch, and my previous work, I worked in Louisiana as well as the District of Columbia on tobacco control. This panel is of particular excitement to me, so it's quite good to be here today. So, just the standing disclaimer that none of the information in this material is a formal dissemination of information from the FDA, and I have no personal financial relationships to disclose. So I just wanted to include the learning objectives up here. Our approach is going to be slightly different than my colleagues beforehand. This is going to be a two-part presentation where each of myself and Joel Lester of the Tobacco Control Legal Consortium are going to take 10 minutes of this time. I'm going to really be focusing on learning objectives 1 through 3. So in essence, I'll give you an overview of the FDA, Tobacco Control Act, the Center for Tobacco Products, some reminders on accomplishments to date, our immediate priorities, kind of how we can all think about the future and working together. So given that we don't have a lot of time, I'm going to go ahead and jump right in. For some of you, this may be very familiar, and for others, I just want to make sure that we all have the same the foundation down together. But the Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act gives the FDA the authority to regulate tobacco products intended for human consumption. So more specifically, the law recognizes FDA as the primary regulatory authority with respect to the manufacture, distribution, and marketing of tobacco products to protect public health. So while the law grants us regulatory authority over all tobacco products intended for human consumption, only some of those products were immediately subject to regulation, and these included cigarettes, cigarette tobacco, smokeless, and roll-your-own tobacco. So in order for us to actively regulate other tobacco products, such as cigars, pipes, e-cigarettes, those that are not making a drug claim, as those would fall under another center within the FDA, the FDA will need to assert jurisdiction over these products through a new regulation, which you likely know and are anticipating as the deeming regulation. The Act directs the FDA to use a public health standard when regulating tobacco products, and this is a critical component of our charge. So while FDA has traditionally used a safe and effective regulatory standard, that makes sense for a drug to be proven safe and effective, but clearly that's an impossible regulatory standard for us to apply to tobacco products. So what is meant by the public health standard? If and how will tobacco product X impact not only the individual user, but the entire population of users, former users, never users, could be users? And for those of you who were in my center director, Mitch Zeller's presentation yesterday, he spoke a bit about the net impact or the net population impact and how we must assess that in determining the public health. So the Act includes a series of provisions which are outlined at a very high level here. So for example, in addition to registering products and ingredients with the FDA, the industry must report harmful and potentially harmful constituents, otherwise known as HPHCs, and their levels for the tobacco products. FDA can then use this information to educate the public about these constituents and their dangers. Furthermore, we can also use this information to establish tobacco product standards to protect the public's health. For example, we could lower the level of nicotine in these products to make them less addictive, as Richard's already alluded to, though we're not able to lower it to zero. Or we could reduce the toxicity or appeal of tobacco products. And in the context of the end games, this may be perhaps our most powerful tool. Products that are to be advertised and promoted as modified risk are subject to FDA's pre-market review and require a modified risk tobacco product or MRTP order. An application must be submitted for each product desiring an MRTP order that provides evidence to support the specific disease reduction or exposure reduction claim that the manufacturer wishes to make for that product. So as I had mentioned, with not being able to reduce nicotine levels to zero, there are some limitations to the Act. For example, and these are particularly important in the context of our discussion about state and locality, their efforts, typically our authorities do not extend to taxation, smoke-free air policies, therapeutic products, for example, nicotine replacement therapy, NRT, those fall to other centers within the FDA, or being able to ban an entire class of tobacco products. However, despite these limitations, the Act remains quite robust. So the Act gave the FDA broad authorities to regulate tobacco products, as well as it spelled out clear, specific statutory milestones. So just to give you a refresh on these, I'm hoping that most, if not all, of these are familiar to you all. For example, banning flavored cigarettes with the exception of menthol, banning misleading advertisements, advertising such as light, low, and mild, and establishing a list of harmful and potentially harmful constituents. So now that I've kind of given you a very rapid upshot of what the basics of the Act are and what's in it and what's not, and some examples of the accomplishments to date, what does all this mean in terms of where the FDA is going from here and how we can interact with our public health stakeholders, such as you, in implementing the Tobacco Control Act? As a regulatory agency, and you've heard this before, there are limitations to what we're able to list out in terms of anticipated regulatory priorities or actions beyond that which is explicitly listed in the Act or that we've announced through the proper administrative procedures, such as the Federal Register. However, there are a couple insights that we can provide you with. Our regulatory framework, immediate priorities, as outlined by my director yesterday for those of you who were able to participate in that, and our research priorities. So I want to run through a little bit of that in rapid fire here. So the principles or the framework through which we can use our regulatory, I like to refer to this as our regulatory universe, which these eight kind of pillars do represent. So our regulatory universe, where we're using our regulatory authority to understand the regulated products, control product changes, prohibit unauthorized claims, restrict marketing and distribution, decrease harms of products, ensure industry compliance, educate the public, and expand the regulatory science base. So while we don't have time to run through kind of the immediate priorities in great detail, I do want to provide a pretty quick snapshot of our immediate priorities or our regulatory framework in action. The first of which is substantial equivalence, or SE. So this is one review path a manufacturer may choose to sell a new tobacco product. To be substantially equivalent, a product must have the same characteristics as a predicate tobacco product or have different characteristics that don't raise a new question about public health. If the new tobacco product raises different questions of public health, the product is not substantially equivalent and cannot be sold, otherwise known as a NSE, or not substantially equivalent. FDA's first tobacco product review decisions were released in June of this year, and we have now issued 9 SEs, and perhaps more importantly, 13 NSEs. In terms of menthol, CTP has open advanced notice of proposed rulemaking that's open through November 22nd, through which we're seeking additional information to make informed decisions about potential regulatory options related to menthol cigarettes. We are also supporting research efforts to better understand the difference between menthol and non-menthol cigarettes. And additionally, menthol will be included as a focus in our to-be-released media campaign in early 2014. In terms of deeming, FDA is getting closer to releasing proposed rule to broaden the scope of our regulatory program to encompass other tobacco products. The NPRM is currently with OMB for its review, where it's been since October 1st, and we're anxiously awaiting next steps, as I'm sure you all are as well. Compliance and enforcement. The Act authorizes the FDA to contract with states, territories, tribes to carry out inspections of retailers to determine compliance with regulations restricting the sale, distribution, and marketing of tobacco products. Currently, we have contracts with 45 jurisdictions, and to date we've invested over $90 million in these compliance checks. Next, in terms of our public education campaigns, CTP is working very hard on multiple integrated paid media campaigns to educate youth and young adults about the dangers of tobacco products to prevent initiation and encourage cessation. Key messaging areas will include addiction, health consequences, and harmful and potentially harmful constituents. Initial campaigns will focus on youth tobacco prevention and general market youth ages 12 to 17 who are categorized as experimenters. And so there's going to be a lot more to come about that in the near future as we approach the launch. Lastly, investments in regulatory science. As with many of the line items here, this probably warrants an entire session, if not a series of sessions, but a couple examples of this. So the FDA is funding the Population Assessment of Tobacco or Health, the PATH study. This is a groundbreaking longitudinal cohort study of nearly 60,000 participants through NIDA. PATH will include youth, an oversampling of high-risk populations, and biomarkers, and it's currently in the field right now collecting baseline data. Also, the FDA and NIH recently announced the award of 14 tobacco centers of regulatory science, so totaling $53 million in this fiscal year alone to establish the T-Cores. This is a first-of-its-kind program designed to generate research to inform the regulation of tobacco products. What's not represented here, and those of you who were participating in yesterday's panel that included Mitch Zeller, and I know it's of great interest to you all as we think of the future, are product standards and comprehensive nicotine regulatory policy. For a number of reasons, Mitch is able to speak to that in ways I'm not. However, I do urge you, if you can, to go back and look at the presentation that was yesterday. It was quite helpful. So finally, as we think about where we're going, in addition to that regulatory framework and these priorities that I've just outlined, I want to point to our research priorities. So again, CTP has identified a series of research questions for which we're looking for additional information that's going to identify and inform future regulatory actions. So for example, nicotine, other tobacco products, toxicity, consumer perception, and effective communication strategies. So while we can't truly outline for you our internal list of regulatory actions being developed, we can share with you our current research priorities, which will inform our future regulatory actions, which we hope is helpful. So lastly here, in addition to where FDA is going, we're often asked, you know, what can we do to help? Where the best for us to jump in? So here's our response. These seven kind of actions are critical supports to our ability to effectively and efficiently implement the Tobacco Control Act. So for the sake of time, I'm not going to go through all these because I think also Joelle's going to speak to some of these, but it's just a great example of the kinds of things that we need from you all to help us do this work. Also, just a list of resources that are available to you to kind of help do that work. On our website, obviously the links are all here. It's very dense, I apologize, but I wanted to make sure that people had access to these links. You can review the Tobacco Control Act. You can search by keyword. You can monitor the Federal Register. Obviously, every regulatory action that we take is listed in the Federal Register. Becoming acquainted with the regulatory process. Regulations.gov does have some great tools, although more to come, we hope, for translating that process. The information on the research priorities, as well as the funding mechanisms that exist, what's been funded to date, deadlines, et cetera, you can access through that link. If you want to learn more about compliance and enforcement in your community, that is there. And then just a final pitch, so that I represent the Public Health Liaison Branch, so my entire job is to be a resource to you all and to help kind of translate what we do and what you all do and somehow find a way that's going to be mutually supportive under the implementation of the Tobacco Control Act is the important caveat that's always there. And then finally, I just want to put in a plug for CTP's one-stop social media shop. You can find everything you need for social media, Twitter, listservs, RSS feeds, blogs, et cetera, you name it, it's all there. And so for additional questions, please feel free to contact me. And now with that rapid whirlwind, I will turn this over to Joelle.
Hello, I'm Joelle Lester. I'm a staff attorney with the Tobacco Control Legal Consortium, and I'm going to talk a little bit about what you can do as public health professionals in states and communities around the country to engage with the FDA's regulatory process, and also how your work at the local level just for your community can also benefit and strengthen the federal process. First, I'd just like to say that I have nothing to disclose. And for those of you who don't know, the consortium is a national legal network. We're supporting state and local policy professionals and advocates on their tobacco control work. We are affiliated with legal centers around the country, so if one of these legal centers is in your state, you're in luck. They can provide legal technical assistance to you, and you should give them a call. If none of these are in your state, never fear. The folks at the consortium in St. Paul, Minnesota can provide free legal technical assistance to you anywhere in the country to help you develop strong, effective tobacco control policies and also assist with some defense against litigation challenges from the industry. So, since Ashley and the other presenters already covered some of the authority under the Act and what the FDA is up to, I'm going to skip all of that and talk a little bit about what the FDA could be doing that we'd like to see them do. They have all the authority to do all of the things on this screen, and I just want to talk about a couple of them. Some of these are on the horizon, or the research is underway. So you see the regulation of nicotine levels is something all the presenters have talked about. Mitch Zeller yesterday spoke quite a bit about his interest in developing comprehensive nicotine regulatory policy, which is really exciting to hear. But that isn't exactly teed up yet for involvement from all of you. However, there are a couple of things, menthol and tobacco products, the deeming regulation to assert jurisdiction over other tobacco products that are a little bit more imminent, and I'll be sharing those action opportunities in just a moment. I would also like to mention that there are a lot of gaps in the regulation of tobacco products that the FDA has already implemented, and so just to mention, for example, the characterizing flavor ban for cigarettes, that's statutory language. The Tobacco Control Act says no fruit or candy flavors in cigarettes, but they exempted menthol and the flavored tobacco. So obviously the menthol is a huge gap in that regulation that we'd really like to see the FDA close. But also, the term characterizing flavor is not defined. And so the way the FDA has applied that is just to mean that you can't market cigarettes with any of those flavors, but it doesn't actually restrict the tobacco companies from adding those flavors to the cigarettes. Which relates to another gap, which you can see lower, which is color coding. Right now, both with flavors and with the restriction on light, low tar, mild descriptors on cigarettes, those can be translated quite easily into color coding packages. So the companies still have the ability to convey these really deceptive messages, and it would be great to see the FDA use the regulatory process to close some of these gaps that were left by the Tobacco Control Act. I would also like to address the bottom bullet point, which a prior presenter talked about. Almost everything that we would like to see the FDA do in terms of restricting access to cigarettes and other tobacco products, the industry, their big message is, illicit trade, smuggling, mafia, and it would be really terrific if the FDA would use the authority it has to address illicit trade and just eliminate that that sort of opposition to all the other great public health measures that they could take. There are a whole other set of things that we at the Tobacco Control Legal Consortium would like to see the FDA do that we think would also improve the process by opening it up to greater, more meaningful participation by public health professionals and tobacco control experts in the field. The process the regulatory process, and this is not specific actually to the FDA, the regulatory process is often very confusing and very opaque. And it is our position that it should be a more public and transparent process, and that it would improve everyone's ability to access that process and would result in stronger, better regulation of tobacco products in this case. And so we would really like to see the FDA hold more frequent public hearings, provide greater notice for those public hearings to allow folks like yourselves with maybe limited budgets to travel to Rockville, Maryland, the opportunity to make those plans, allow people to testify remotely at the hearings, or hold the hearings outside of the DC area, allow all public comments on the public dockets to be viewed by the public. That sounds ridiculous, but allow me to give you an example. Right now, the menthol docket that the FDA opened that Ashley talked about earlier, there are about 200,000 comments have been submitted on that docket, but about 185 are visible to the public on regulations.gov, the website. So That's a very small percentage, and it when you withhold some of that information from all of us, it's very hard to get a sense of what kind of information is in the docket. In the docket is the official record that the FDA is going to rely upon to make informed decisions about menthol policy or whatever other policy the docket is for, and we would really like to see more transparency in that area. And then finally, the FDA has been relying a little bit on FOIA for all of, as a tool for us to get information that they don't, we shouldn't have to always submit a FOIA request. They could go ahead and make a lot of information affirmatively public. And I would say for that last one, that there has been a little bit of a change in the right direction since the new center director took over, Mitch Zeller, in March of this year, and we would just really like to see a lot more progress in openness and transparency at the agency. Okay, so let's talk about the opportunities for engaging the FDA for all of you. And okay, I thought there was one more down there. So this is sort of the whole spectrum of activities that you could engage in, and a lot of this is just building on the work you're already doing in your community and connecting it with the work that the FDA is doing on regulating tobacco products to try to better inform their process. So the first one I really want to highlight is actually just the work you're doing to implement bold tobacco control policies in your community. And you should be doing that, of course, because it benefits health in your community, but this can really help the FDA, I think. It can push the FDA to be bolder and think bigger if you are being bold and thinking big in your community. It also gives an opportunity to evaluate the effectiveness of a policy and collect data on how that is improving public health in your community that you could then submit to the FDA to show that that policy is working at on a small scale and it could probably be even more effective on a larger scale. I just want to give examples and hat tip, I guess, to Providence, Rhode Island and the city of New York for the prohibiting flavored other tobacco products. They both endured significant litigation challenges and prevailed, which is fantastic because it gives you some guidance on what's possible in your community, but it also gives an opportunity to collect data that could be helpful to the FDA on that topic as well. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about the kinds of local tobacco control policies that are possible under the Tobacco Control Act, powers that are still reserved to states and local governments. But I just would also like to point out, you know, there are advisory committees. Right now, the Tobacco Products Scientific Advisory Committee is taking nominations for a voting member. If you have the kind of medical and scientific background they're looking for, that's something you should consider. It'd be excellent to have more public health experts at the table there. You can comment on proposed rules, guidance documents, and citizen petitions. All of those open dockets for public comments, and I'll show you in a minute just how you find those dockets and submit information. If you are a scientist or a researcher, it is so helpful if you can take what you are doing and get it to the FDA. Publishing the results of your excellent work is not quite enough to make sure that the FDA knows about the results of your research. And so we just really encourage you to submit it on in a comment to the FDA just to make sure that they have all of this great information that you have worked so hard to gather before them to inform their thinking. And then mailing, calling, emailing, buttonholing people at conferences, which I saw people do to Mr. Zeller yesterday, that's all excellent. I personally call Ashley Ross all the time. She's still nice to me mostly, but I just strongly encourage you to just make your presence known at every level at the FDA. There are current action opportunities that I would encourage you to consider engaging in. As Ashley mentioned, there is the advance notice of proposed rulemaking on menthol. That docket is open until November 22nd. If you haven't submitted a comment yet, I encourage you to do so. Track and Trace is a program to combat illicit trade that is authorized under the Tobacco Control Act that the FDA has not yet done. So the City of New York submitted a citizen petition calling on the FDA to implement the Track and Trace program. You could submit a comment on that topic. We have a citizen petition calling on the FDA to assert jurisdiction over other tobacco products. Unfortunately, it's not yet posted on regs.gov, but we hope it will appear any minute, and we will send out an alert once it's up. And then I mentioned the opening on TPSAC. Just briefly, the citizen petitions that I mentioned, the track and trace and the other tobacco products one, citizen petitions are a formal process established in regulation calling on a federal agency to take a specific action and the agency has to respond, and also they open a docket for public comment. So it's a useful tool. When the FDA is not taking any public action on an issue you would like to see public action on, it's a way to sort of create a platform for public health involvement and engagement with the FDA on that issue. So we have filed a couple of those. The one on the left is our menthol petition, which we filed in April. And then since then, they issued the menthol ANPRM, and that is the docket you should focus on. And then the one on the right is the OTP petition. So just briefly, you can find docket information on our website. We've created the FDA Tobacco Action Center. It's publichealthlawcenter.org is our website. And this is the page on the FDA project. Here, the first take action button is press the FDA to take action on menthol, and you'll have direct links to suggested talking points and the public docket, which looks like this. The arrow is pointing to the button you click on to submit your comment, but I do just want to point out, you can see in the right corner 110,677 comments. This is from last week, actually. But in smaller language, it says they've actually received closer to 200,000 comments, including 4 write-in campaigns. And I want to tell you, I don't think that these are all from public health professionals. I think that there's a lot of tobacco users submitting comments because I have seen Lorillard's call to action that they have been sending out to their users. And I just have to tell you, if you have any reservations about participating in this process, they are participating in droves. And this is the record. The FDA has to, they have to review all these comments, and they have to make decisions based on the information that's in the record. And if the public health community doesn't show up, we are really doing the FDA a disservice and ourselves a disservice. We want them to have all of this good information that we know is out there in your communities in their record so they make the best, boldest possible decisions about the regulation of menthol in this case and other tobacco products. This is the comment. Once you click on the comment button, this is what you see. The big box, you can just type in a brief comment if you like. And there's a button below that says upload files, and you can upload your entire published article, a more formal letter or statement, survey data, anything that you have that you think would be helpful to inform the FDA's process. And then here's just a couple of sample comments. This one's from Professor Carter. He just wrote a short comment, and then he attached a published article that he had written that he thought was relevant to the issue of menthol cigarettes. And then this is Minnesota State Commissioner of Health wrote a more formal letter and uploaded that as an attachment on menthol. So if you're wondering what kind of information is helpful to the FDA, we often hear that they want data and research. So if you have survey data, scientific research that you've conducted, it is helpful if you have an article that you're going to submit that you include your credentials and explain the relevance of the article to the regulatory issue that you're submitting it on. We have seen really interesting things from locally elected officials, such as passing resolutions that include survey data about the health impact of menthol in their community. Solano County tobacco prevention folks have been really energetic and creative in this regard, and it's a really nice way to get information to the FDA. And then I just want to briefly review the areas of regulation that are still available at the local level. So you don't have to wait for the FDA. And actually, I would say, generally speaking, I wouldn't wait for the FDA to take action. Their process is just slower. It's slow. It's really slow. You are probably aware of that 4 years into the Tobacco Control Act. And so don't wait for them to do something when you could be taking a lot of interesting and bold actions yourself in your community in the area of youth access, taxation, you know, prohibiting samples. And as was mentioned before, you can prohibit entire classes of products, and all of this could be both good for your community and push the FDA to do more with their authority. If you have any questions, I'm also at booth 838 for the rest of the conference, and I love to talk about this, so please come and visit. And also, we provide assistance in our office to you if you want to participate in the process, or if you have any local tobacco control issues you'd like help with, please contact us. Thank you.
I'm sure you all agree with me that that was a fabulous panel, and we do have time for questions, and it's certainly a very exciting topic, so we're going to open up for questions. Please say who you are, and if you have a preference as to whom you would like to respond to your question, say that as well. Thank you.
Laurie Thomas, Office of Chief Tobacco and Joint Prevention. Roll up.
Yes. Thank you very much. I was wondering if, Joelle, if you could talk a little bit about track and trace, just a little bit.
Yeah. You pass the mic down.
Oh,
no. I think that may be difficult.
Can you do it?
We'll just do it. You can just do it here. It's okay. They should have given us a second one, but we don't have a second one.
Track and trace would be a process by which the federal government could require basically a little like code be attached at the point of manufacture to packages of cigarettes or other tobacco products. So you would be able to see the entire sort of lifeline of that particular package of tobacco products, which would help track down. There's a lot of tax evasion, especially in states where there's a particularly high tax next to a state where there's particularly low tax. And in New York City, this is a big issue because they have very high cigarette taxes, and so they have a lot of problems with folks selling cigarettes without the tax stamp that they get from neighboring states. So this is, it's just really a program, exactly how it sounds, I guess, to keep track of where products are and to identify the places where people are breaking the law and participating in tax evasion or other kinds of smuggling. But it would certainly be helpful when you think of some of these other restrictions that we'd like to see and the FDA extending its authority over other tobacco products for enforcement purposes to be able to get the full picture of who is avoiding or evading some of the restrictions. And that there's a link to that full petition on that same, the FDA Action Center, and the petition explains the whole issue and provides some supporting evidence also.
Yes, here, and then we'll go over there.
I'm not Tali Offen, UCSF in California. Thank you for a very valuable panel. And I'm curious that nobody mentioned one thing as a possibility to do to advance what we'd like to see, and that's filters. There's been a lot of research on the fact that it was one of the first things the industry did that was a ploy. They were only concerned about the PR, and that I have heard that it not only does nothing, that the lung cancer that people are getting is worse with the filters than before because people are breathing deeper. So is that at all in the is under discussion anywhere as a possibility? Certainly would really harm the industry.
Ruth Starr. Well,
I think Libby Smith, my colleague Libby Smith, knows a bit more about this than I do, but I don't know of any place that's actually actively talking about this now. But Robert Proctor has done a lot of work on this in his book Golden Holocaust, and he talks about how we are seeing a different kind of lung cancer because the filters allow people to inhale more deeply and to get those particles deeper into the lungs. And there are other design features too. I mean, I think these fall into the category of product regulation and certainly would also be something that potentially could be taken up, I would think, by FDA. But I don't think there's any active conversation on it.
Well, to interject, there is active conversation about the litter created by butts and the complexity of it bio-amplifying within waterways and the like. So there's a whole group working on that. So if you search butts, it'll come up. Tom Novotny is the person who's been leading the effort. We have a question back there. Did you want to add to that question? Okay, sorry.
Can we this way? Thank you. Yes, so as you've already alluded to, it does fall under the purview of the product regulation, and it's certainly something that we're very aware of. I wanted to allude to tobacco product manufacturing practices that are also part of what the FDA is considering, or TPMPs. It's our version of GMPs, or the manufacturing practices. So we're looking at all of the facets within the cigarette itself and understanding, again, what are the components of it? How is it used? How is it affecting the population health, and what can be done about that?
Yes.
Thank you, Lori, from Minnesota. I appreciate the panel. Joel, I would just ask you to go back to your slides again. Because I tried yesterday after your presentation today to go on your website to log a comment on the, and I do not see what you are showing there. So, okay.
So if you go to our, this is not our main page. So our main page is the Public Health Law Center, and then you click on FDA Tobacco Action Center, which is a little box in a colorful banner of boxes across it, and you'll get to this page. And then you should see, it should look exactly like this, although we need to improve the website, but the first one under Take Action Today will be menthol.
Okay. Thank you.
Start with Dick.
I don't think the FDA is under, you know, any particular pressure from the tobacco industry. Obviously, the tobacco industry would do whatever it could on these issues, but I can't imagine that. And they do have a couple of non-voting representatives on TPSAC, but you know, I don't think that's the main problem. That's the main cause of the delay. I don't think Congress is either. Congress is what? I mean, what does Congress do these days? I mean, it's not clear to me that, you know, I guess Congress, you know, often threatens, you know, congressional committees will threaten an agency and put pressure that way. Not aware of that happening around this. I think the blame has to be put on the Obama administration. I mean, the FDA is not an independent federal agency. It's part of Department of Health and Human Services. It reports to the president. OMB, the folks who are currently looking over the deeming regulation, you know, is one way that the White House controls the agencies. And, you know, I'm sure most of us voted for Obama, but, you know, that doesn't mean you give him a buy on this thing. And you got to, I think that's where the pressure has to be put if we want to see some movement. I think the FDA, Office of Tobacco, Center for Tobacco Products. Sorry, I think these guys at this point are pretty sophisticated, and they may not have been when they got going 4 years ago. I think they're pretty sophisticated now. They know what needs to be done. They probably don't actually need a lot of guidance from us. But the question is, are they going to be encouraged to take strong stands, allowed to take strong stands, or prevented from taking strong stands?
I agree with Dick, and I think that that's part of where we really have to mobilize the public health community nationally, because we know that at the federal level, we have always been weakest. We finally have this agency. We have the right people in the agency. We need to hold the feet to the fire of the administration and make it an embarrassment for them if they don't act. So they need lots of comments, lots more comments on those websites from public health people to make it clear that we are not going to stand still for this, and it is going to be a terrible embarrassment for them. Now, I do think, you know, Mitch Seller took over about 8 months ago, and I think things are moving faster. It's my sense that we may be looking at some progress here, and possibly it'll be coordinated with the new Surgeon General's report, which will be out early next year, which I'm feeling encouraged about.
So we have a lot of people who want to ask questions. We do still have 10 minutes. That's a good thing. So keep your hands up so I know where you are. I'm going to go 1, 2, 3. Okay, so let's start over here.
Thank you.
Right. I think the work has been, the focus of this originally was, this was hatched in Singapore, and for two or three years, I think most of the work on it was restricted to Singapore, and then it became public. So I think they are doing studies there of you know, children's reactions, which my understanding is, of course, are totally positive. This is not a hard one to organize young people around. They don't smoke. At, you know, at a certain age, they think it's a stupid idea, and you know, you can get them to you know, come to legislative hearings at any level and say as much, and that they want to be protected and so forth. I'm being asked about this, let me just say that at Northeastern University, where I teach at the law school a couple of miles from here, we're going to be having a conference on endgame strategies focused on the ones available in the U.S., and particularly on the tobacco-free generation. We're going to have it at some point in 2014. We were shooting for the spring. It may slip to the fall. But anybody who's interested in this, please keep an eye on our website, phaionline.org, says Lizzie Friedman, one of our folks. We would love to have you here and love to do whatever we can to support this process. And obviously, we would be delighted to have folks from Wales. I don't think we're going to say anything about the U.S. that couldn't be applied with a couple of obvious changes to anywhere else in the world.
So I'm assuming we're going to have to let people get in, so I'm going to do two more questions. So one back there. Well, I should say that in outlining my thought that I am not carrying water for the e-cigarette industry. I mean, I do not think that in a real, in a, the best of all possible worlds, we would say, hey, these are great. And I'm not saying that now. We don't know enough yet about them. We don't have enough science yet to really say that they are safe. And in fact, there turn out to be all kinds of nasty little things in them and in the vapor. It's not just water, like, you know, they want to say. But the fact is that I think there's pretty good consensus, and I'm not sure where you saw this report. I think there's pretty good consensus that it's very unlikely that these products are worse than typical combustible cigarettes are, about which we know a great deal. So in the best of all possible worlds, would I have these come on to the market? No, but they're already here. So I'm talking about the world in which we already live, where these things are out there. And is there a way that we can leverage this fact to talk about the real problem that we have wrestled with for 100 years, you know, and which created this hideous epidemic
over the last century. And I think there might be. I don't know. I'm just saying that for me personally, that's a trade-off I might be willing to risk. And then we can deal with figuring out what we're going to do about e-cigarettes, which I don't think they should be widely marketed to kids and all that. I don't think they should be allowed in smoke-free places. I don't want to breathe those nanoparticles. But I think there may be opportunities here from a balancing perspective that we shouldn't rule out altogether. So I think you're right to say, no, you can't smoke them in our class.
Okay, come on up. One more addition and then one more question and then we're done, sadly.
I would just say that there isn't, we don't really know, and once the FDA, the reason it's important for the FDA to assert jurisdiction is we are going to know a lot more because the FDA will have the authority then to require ingredient lists, to monitor manufacturing practices. There will be a lot more information about the health impact, and I think then we can make an informed decision about how much safer, if not safe, those products might be and make more decisions about the kind of restrictions. Oh, and also advertising restrictions will also be easier for the possible for the FDA to impose once they've asserted jurisdiction, which is why it's so important for them to do that.
Okay, one last question. I'm going to go right in the middle there.
Aren't there a number of contracts already in place with the AG's office and FDA? I mean, maybe you can respond in that respect.
That is a huge problem. There are some states, like the state of Washington, I believe, eliminated all of their tobacco control funding. And I know the CDC Community Transformation Grant funding has filled in a little bit of the loss there, but it's not enough. And they have limitations on policy work, unfortunately. And so that is a huge loss for the communities where states have defunded tobacco programs. Some states have gotten it back. Colorado lost some funding and then got it back. And so I think that's, you know, for those states who have lost a lot of their funding for tobacco control work, the first order of business is restoring funding before they can do all this really important policy work. But it's, in addition to the CDC, there's compliance and enforcement funding.
Yeah, again, I can only speak to the element of that that's related to the Tobacco Control Act. We do have the contracts that we're trying to establish with all of the eligible jurisdictions throughout the country, and those vary in terms of the award size and the scope, but those will be in effect for quite some time, I would imagine, to continue the enforcement, again, of the Tobacco Control Act. But there's other elements, if you're speaking specifically about enforcement within the state. SINAR has a component, you know, with that, so the SAMHSA block grants, state and local authorities, et cetera, are all kind of circling around that mechanism to make sure that all of the tobacco control or enforcement laws are being upheld.
And I would just add one element, and that's the recent settlement around diligent enforcement by AG. So I think that's also a factor in that there's a stick if a state fails to enforce. And so it's really about the MSA, but the MSA has lots of restrictions that dovetail with things that the FDA are doing. So I'd just like to wrap up by saying I'm sure some of the speakers here will stay around and ask a few more questions if they don't have to rush off, and to thank them for giving us such a fabulous overview of the whole question of endgame strategy, something that I certainly hope I live to see for the sake of my three children and their children. So thank you all for coming, and thanks so much to the panel.